attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business, and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chin wag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we filled a brief with emojis, rude doodles, and quotes from the Goonies in order to earn a professional intervention from marketing's master of meaningful briefs, Howard Iback. An instructor at the Association of National Advertisers Marketing Training and Development Center, author of How to Write an Inspired Brief, and host of the Brief Bros podcast, Howard is essentially Brief Batman, only he shares knowledge and guidance instead of biffs in the face. A true believer in the power of the brief to unlock the higher levels of creative thinking, Howard runs a creative brief mastery program designed to promote clear thinking, true collaboration, and the Holy Grail, a single-minded proposition, all in order to come up with briefs that act like a greasy zip wire straight to the good stuff. Howard says the best creative briefs are brief, a page, maybe a page and a half. But we're afraid that we're not going to give the creatives everything they need, so marketers tend to pile on. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Well, thank you, Giles. That was quite the introduction. I appreciate that very much, and I look forward to a fun conversation with you today.
Good stuff. Right, seven quick fires, Howard. Reading or writing?
Yes.
Number two, California or Wisconsin?
Oh, Wisconsin, easily.
The Mario Brothers or the Brief Brothers?
The Brief Brothers. And you forgot to mention Henry Gomez. He's my co-host and co-conspirator.
So, well, hold that thought, Howard. Number four, clear objectives or clear targeting?
Clear objectives.
Right, quote time. A good brief is like a love letter to the creative team, or the brief isn't just a piece of paper, it's the ignition for an idea.
Yes.
Two more. Writing a brief or writing a single-minded proposition?
Oh my. Well, I would say you have to write a brief before you can get to the single-minded proposition.
Good answer. Right, finally, and you've mentioned him once already, Henry Gomez or Selena Gomez?
Henry, absolutely Henry. He'd kill me if I didn't say that.
He'd kill me if he wasn't on the quickfires too. There we go. Lovely.
Yeah.
Shout out to Henry. Brilliant. Well, listen, Howard, thanks for joining us. We just caught up. I was going to say off air, but before we recorded, you've just left London. Sadly, we didn't cross paths. You've been busy, so you can tell us a bit about that. But first, can you tell us and our listeners about your first ever job? So how did it start for you?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I think the job that qualifies as my first job, and the one that I think about the most and that I've learned about myself the most, was between my sophomore and junior years of college. I was a stonemason for a swimming pool manufacturing company in Tampa, Florida. And
wow.
I learned how to mix concrete and to pour stones from a 70-year-old semi-retired stonemason named Gus. And he would drop in once or twice a week during my summer tenure. But he was the man who showed me how to do this. And I say showed because I think in the entire summer that we knew each other, we didn't exchange more than 10 words. And that's what made the job memorable, besides the fact that I got incredibly buff and lean from, you know, lifting stones. But writers are taught very early on, show, don't tell. And that's how he taught me how to pour concrete stones for the swimming pools that were being built. He didn't tell me how to do it. He just said, he showed me. And I just paid attention and learned. And I didn't understand that lesson right away. But I look back on that now and say, here's a man who is not very articulate, but he knows how to do what he does. And I've never forgotten that. So that was a job I'll never forget.
Wow. Was it just Gus wasn't really a talker?
No. In the dictionary next to the word reticent is his picture.
Was he a reluctant teacher?
No, I think he was happy to teach. He wasn't loquacious. He would rather just say, watch what I do, rather than try to explain it. He didn't have the vocabulary to explain what he was doing, so he just showed me. And I was visual enough to follow along, and I asked questions and he would answer, and I had to pour 100 stones every day. And they were various sizes, but there were little frames that he had built over the course of the years, and he showed me how to mix the concrete and pour the stones. And I didn't realize how much concrete powder could transfer to my clothes and into my car and into my apartment as I did that summer. Like I said, I got really buff and lean from all that lifting.
I doubt there's many unfit stonemasons. I mean, No. Maybe there's stonemasons with bad habits, but I don't know. I'm not going to speculate. How does one become a stonemason? And how did you end up being one, albeit temporarily, I assume?
My uncle was a senior lawyer for the Shriners Organization, which is a nonprofit over here in the States that works to build hospitals for children. And I think the owner of this pool company was a big donor to the Shriners, and my uncle helped me get a job there. I just needed a summer job. They were going to send me out with their crew of these, 6'4", big hulking young men who actually dig the holes in the ground and build the pools. I think they took pity on me when they saw me. I was just, 160 pounds in the heat of a Tampa summer. And I think they said, no, he's not going to last more than a couple of hours. So they sent me to the relatively cooler, in shade stone yard. And that's where I met Gus. And I think he looked at me and said, okay, we'll see what we can do here. And I turned out to be a not bad student. So that's how I got the job.
Nice. Good stuff. So you said that happened over the summer. Was this during college, university?
Yes. I was a student at the University of Tampa, and this was my first summer there. So I needed something to do to earn a little money, to pay the rent and things. So that was my, it wasn't a full-time job. It was just a summer job. And it was a lot more physical work than I've ever done before or since. But I've never forgotten those lessons. You either are building self-awareness by paying attention to what's going on around you, or you're not. And I was looking back on that. I said, wow, I actually got a lot more from that job than lean and mean.
I really enjoy the stories that this question elicits on the podcast. And I find that very frequently, despite the huge variety of jobs that have been discussed, and I'm pretty sure that you're our first stonemason, how when people look back in the rearview mirror, they kind of really see the value that they may not have appreciated at the time. But at the time you were at University of Tampa, I believe you were studying writing. What led you to choose to pursue writing?
I was a handful of credits away from getting my degree in English, but the year before I graduated, the university initiated a brand new major, and it was in writing. And I was studying poetry and fiction. I was a student journalist. My junior year, I was the assistant editor of our university newspaper, The Minaret, which was half scholarship. And in my senior year, I was named editor, which was full scholarship. And then I'm going to kind of hint at what my first, real job was. I had an internship with a local sports franchise. So I was writing. I was doing all kinds of writing. And when they offered the degree in writing, a BA in writing, I said, why not? I mean, I've already been taking so many classes. I'd been published as a journalist, been published as a poet, had been published as a short fiction writer. It just made sense. I wish now that I had devoted a little more time and finished the minor requirements for English. I was a few credits shy, so I only have the major. But that's how I chose writing.
Nice. I like the fact, and just an observation of mine, that it included, or your interest included, poetry and fiction from the off. What I found in the 160 plus episodes is that we talk to creatives who may sidestep from a world of journalism, which, as I say it, I've just realised is you could also argue is a work of fiction in some instances too, but it's less the creative writing. But that was obviously something that interests you from the off. Were you already aware of the world of advertising, or did that come later?
That came later, although I have to give my father credit with at least planting the seed. And I'm a little fuzzy in my memory as to exactly when he did that. I might have been still in high school, and I don't know what the equivalent of high school is in the UK, but it's the 4 years of school prior to going on to university. I might have been a junior or senior in high school, starting to think about where do I want to go to college? And my dad said, I think you should think about advertising. And that was it. He didn't expand on that. He was a physician. What he knew about advertising, I have no idea, but he just said, I think you should think about advertising. And that was the seed. And I didn't think about it until I finished. I did a master's degree at Brown. I went to study at the Sorbonne after finished the master's degree. And then I realized I need to start paying back my student loans. And I came back to Milwaukee in my hometown. And I started first doing little freelance work with some local friends to build up what I realized I needed, which was a portfolio. And I didn't get my first copywriting job until I was almost 30.
Oh, wow. Okay. Amazing. I wasn't aware of that. I said to you prior to recording that at some point, perhaps even now, I will have to do your career a massive disservice and kind of summarize it in a few minutes, because you've had stints, as well as being freelance, obviously, stints at the likes of DDB, Ogilvy, Wunderman, I mean, a stellar list of agencies. And on Call to Action, we're very good at talking quite widely about careers, but today we have the intention of going very deep on one topic, and that's the topic of briefs. I don't know in our intro whether you preferred the title Brief Batman or Marketing's Master of Meaningful Briefs, but either way, how did you become whichever one of those that we're going to use?
How did I get into this field? Right.
Yeah, because you're coming at it as a creative, and that's another observation that you kind of shared with me, and I haven't necessarily even considered the angle that you were coming to it from, which is interesting in itself.
I think that kind of carves out a niche for me, although that's changing. For example, just last week we had as a guest on the Brief Brothers a young woman named Kit Alton, who is making quite a splash, or has made quite a splash here in the States at the South by Southwest conference last year, again this year, and I think she's been invited back. She started her advertising career as a copywriter and felt that it was very limiting. So she made the jump at the right time earlier in her career into strategy. And now she's the chief global strategy officer, if I got her title correct, at the Cage in London. And she is remarkable. So I never made that leap, but I got into the business because I got tired of reading bad briefs. But no one, you know, and one of the first questions I address in my training is, okay, what the heck is a good brief? Would someone please show me what a good brief is? And it took me years to find examples of that. And even when I found what I thought were good examples, no one else would say, oh, yeah, that's a good one. You should study that one. You should use that one. I had to figure it out. I mean, even reading a great book such as John Steele's Truth, Lies, and Advertising, where he devotes, I think, at least two chapters to the importance of a brief, he never points to an example of a good brief. And I'm not faulting him on that, because I learned from sitting at his you know, side, metaphorically speaking, as I was studying briefs. But where you go to find an example of good brief, I didn't know. So I did the digging. I started asking the questions. I started reading. And slowly but surely, I found examples on the internet of briefs that I thought were good. But I had to figure out what is good. So that's the motivation. The actual straw that broke the back that really turned me toward actually taking this desire and putting it into training. I was creative director at an agency in Minneapolis for the four loyalty programs for British Airways. I had a staff in Minneapolis and I had a staff in New York, which is where the client had its offices. The American client had its offices. And I caught one of my brief writers cutting and pasting a literal couple of paragraphs from the client brief into our brief without making a single change. And this brief writer, she was an account person, didn't realize that I saw both the client brief and the creative brief. So I think she figured I would never know. But I did. I found out. And I took that to my bosses and I said, I want to take the team through a training. And I kid you not, Giles, I didn't get the sentence out of my mouth before my bosses said, yes, 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 we know the briefs suck here. We need to fix them. If you're willing to step up and do some training, you have our blessings. And that was the beginning. That was 20 years ago. So I created a workshop. It was 8 hours long. It's a mixture of 8 and 4 hours. I've got a portfolio of 5 workshops in what's called the Creative Brief Mastery Program. So it has evolved and changed and grown in the last 2 decades.
Amazing. On that particular point, because we've all seen it, and I've seen it fairly recently in truth, can you unpack the cutting and pasting the client brief into the agency brief? Can you just give us a summary of the issues with that?
The creative brief is a thinking document. It's not a form to fill out. A form is like an application for a driver's license or a job application. Every question you know the answer to before you even start. A creative brief is designed to force you to think. You don't know the answer to the questions. There might be one or two, like what is the tone of voice? And that's a brand issue. So you should go to your brand guidelines and cut and paste the brand guidelines indication of what the tone of voice is and cut that into the brief. Otherwise, everything else is new. Who are we talking to? What's the problem we're trying to solve? What's the one thing we're trying to say? And a lot of times brief writers will say, well, we already know our audience. Or just cut and paste the persona. And I say, well, wait a minute. A persona tends to be a collection of tidbits about people who might use your product or service, but they don't add up to anything real. If you look at a really good brief, it's probably written in first person as if the customer is talking right to you. I've seen some great examples of first person descriptions, of who the customer is. So the brief, if you cut and paste from the client brief, you're just lazy. And that's not acceptable. I want you to think about this. And usually it indicates that you're not taking enough time to write the brief. So yeah, that the reason that it's unacceptable is that it indicates a lack of thinking, and this is a document that demands thinking. You know the old phrase, garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
That's how it begins.
Yeah, I think that was Paul Arden, wasn't it? It's one of his quotes. Lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I unfairly asked you to choose between a Dave Trott quote and a Rosie Arnold quote in the quick fires. I don't think I'd really appreciated how long the quotes were as well, and the irony of it being a quick fire. But the quote from Rosie Arnold, which just to repeat is that it's the ignition for an idea, is I've always favoured that myself, and I accept there's an amount of subjectivity at play there. But the idea that it's something that ignites an idea. So it has to have thinking.
I really love the word idea, because too many times a creative brief is written to address or to prescribe tactics. And my thinking is idea first, tactic second. It doesn't end up being that way, because in our world today, media has been separated from the creative process. And so media is often purchased well in advance of any project being briefed, which to me is backwards. It's totally backwards. I mean, why are you buying TV time many products know that they're going to buy, that they're going to use TV, they're going to create a TV campaign or whatever the media might be. But is there room for the creatives to recommend some other tactic that the idea fits ideally with? I don't know if that's a reality these days, but his idea has to come first.
I couldn't agree more. And I've seen evidence that the kind of media and creativity are being recoupled, if you like. The best soundbite I've heard, unsurprisingly, from Rory Sutherland about the decoupling of media and creativity is something along the lines of, it's like cutting up a Sudoku square and asking separate people to solve it.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. I love that. That's perfect.
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, Back to the show.
My first sort of proper paid weekly job was a holiday job as a student, which was driving a forklift truck at the Ribena factory.
Ah, Call to Action, episode 11, with the one and only Rory Sutherland. Not what we were looking for, but hang on a minute. Ah, there we go.
Your issues with the brief, it's something that I think, certainly in the UK, I don't know if it's true of the US, has started to become more of a conversation. And there's a huge disparity between, unsurprisingly, I suppose, between how good people think they are and how good people who receive the briefs think they are, especially if we're looking at a kind of client or brand and agency viewpoint. Do you think, because you would never copy a client's brief into an agency's brief, do you think there's actually two problems there? As in, maybe the client doesn't understand or the brand doesn't understand how to write a great brief, but almost that becomes less relevant if the agency isn't creating their own brief?
The vast majority, I would say 99.9% of the training that I do is with marketers, not with agencies, which is not what I expected when I first launched my training. But that's what it's evolved into. Marketers want to know how to write this document. They know that the document needs to be inspiring, needs to be concise, needs to plant a flag and own something. And so they want to know how this is done, even though they have so many other things on their plate besides writing a brief. Whereas a strategist or an account planner, and it's not all that they do is write a brief, but everything that they do is aimed at supporting the brief or working with their direct reports. So I have to take that in mind when I do training, that you as a marketer have so many other things to do besides write a brief. And you may write a fraction of the number of briefs that a strategist writes. So they still want to know how to do this, and that's the way I go about training, which is why I really promote and push collaboration. And when I say collaboration, I mean, marketer, get yourself a writing buddy. Sit down and write with someone else, just the way an art director and a copywriter team up to form a creative team, which was introduced by Bill Birnbach back in the 50s. It created the revolution we call the golden age of advertising. There are other things, I'm sure, that contributed to it, but putting two heads together was brilliant. And we look back on it now and say, well, yeah, well, what else? I mean, how else could we have done it? Well, we didn't do it that way. So we need to do that kind of thing when you're writing a creative brief. Two heads are better than one. That's something that's easily facilitated in the culture of most companies. They can sit down with another marketer. And then I add to that, I say, you need to loop in a creative. You need to get a creative involved in the process because we have skin in the game. This is our document. Too many times I hear marketers say, well, I collaborate. I write a draft of the brief and then I send it out for comments. And I say, well, that's not collaboration. That's masochism. Because you're now waiting to hear from not your peers, but your seniors. Whose comments are you going to take more seriously? Your peers or your boss? And then, well, they almost always say, oh, yeah, I'm going to wait to hear what my boss has to say. And then my response is, well, now you've just changed the audience for the brief. It's not creatives. It's your boss.
It's your boss, yeah.
So get the creative involved because and that could be your creative director. It could be, you know, a copywriter that you work with. The creatives need to see this in advance. And that's one of the lessons I learned from Henry Gomez, you know, my podcast buddy. One of the first things he does at a new job, if he's started at a new agency, is to start to build that relationship with his creative director. He wants to make sure that the creative director buys off on his early drafts of a brief. He will never spring a brief on the creatives at a kickoff. They've got to see what it's all about in advance. The same is true for marketers, but they don't do it that way. So that's a culture change that my training is designed to change.
Can you talk on the kind of disconnect between clients and agencies when it comes to how clear a brief actually is? Because one of the key findings of the Better Briefs work, which I know you're familiar with, was that 78% of marketers believe they are good at writing briefs and only 5% of creative agencies agree.
Wow, if I knew the answer to that, you know, I'd be rich beyond the dreams of avarice. But I think it reveals how siloed brief writing has become. If you write the document all by yourself, how the heck do you know if it's any good? If the only feedback you get are from other marketers, how the heck do you know if it's any good? I mean, I have done hundreds of workshops in the years that I've been doing this training, obviously a lot more in the last 8 years for the ANA, and they are major brands, and they all have the same laments. You know, how do we know what a good brief is? You know, how do I know if the creators are, you know, do you even know when a creative likes your brief? Have you ever asked your creatives what they think of your briefs? It's a delicate subject and it might be a little scary. So the fact that there's no conversation and this survey that Matt and Peter Paul did opened all of our eyes. I think creatives knew this all along, but here's evidence to back it up. So I think the first thing is to acknowledge that if you are a marketer writing a brief, your brief is going to get changed. No matter how brilliant your brief is, it goes to the agency, they're going to write their own brief. And that's just the way of the world. And maybe that brief will be shared with you. Maybe it won't. But the better the brief that you deliver to the agency, the more likely they are to be on board. And one of the astounding but not so astounding discoveries of their more recent, of Peter Paul and Matt's most recent survey about the evaluation of ideas was the change since 2007 on the number of rounds it takes before a client will buy off on an idea. In 2007, according to the IPA, your wonderful organization there in London, Institute for the Practitioners of Advertising, in 2007, they said the average number of rounds before an idea is bought off on is 3. As of 2024, which I think is the last year they have for research, that has gone from 3 to 5 rounds. It's gotten worse. And I know exactly where to point the finger of blame. It's at the brief. The brief is the first step of the creative process. So you blow it there, everything falls apart. So the agencies and the creatives need to get closer together, and that's with a tighter brief. So I'm happy to contribute to helping marketers write tighter briefs. And I hope that, you know, baby steps, moves the needle a little bit toward giving agencies what they need in terms of the starting point for their creative brief. It is the first step in the creative process. It's not part of strategy. It's the first step of the creative process.
I'm raiding my memory bank here, which is always prone to failure, but I know you're familiar with Vicky Ross. He's a big friend of ours.
Yes.
Her brother Adam was on the podcast a few months ago. Adam works in Sydney at Coca-Cola, and he taught brilliantly on the briefing process or their creative process, more broadly speaking. And I think he said the brief is the first expression of the creative idea or the creative strategy, which I thought was a really nice articulation.
That's what Sir John Haggerty said. I mean, John Steele quoted Sir John in 97, 96, whenever that book came out, a long time ago. And I've used that as a measuring stick for judging a brief. Sir John Haggerty said, I take the proposition, the single-minded proposition, or whatever you want to call it, on the brief. I write that down on a piece of blank paper, and I put a picture of the product above or below that, and then I stick that on the wall. And then I ask myself, okay, is this a good ad? I don't need it to be a great ad. It just needs to be a good ad. And if it's a good ad, if I can say, yeah, that's not bad. Number one, I've got a good brief. And number two, I know what my job is to make that ad better. So that's a great test to determine whether you have the beginnings of a brief. The best definition of creative brief I've ever heard came from a marketer. And I got this when I was doing a training. He said, a creative brief is the emotional translation of the strategy. There's just one little problem with that. And Peter, Paul, and Matt revealed this in their first survey. 60% of marketers admitted that they use the creative process to figure out the strategy. So if you haven't got a strategy, how do you write a brief? I don't have an answer to that one yet, but I love that definition. It's the emotional translation of the strategy if you got a strategy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're quite lucky here because we really sweat the briefs here because we work with a whole roster of writers, and I happen to know of at least two who won't work with most other agencies because of the quality of their briefs. Whereas because we really sweat them, we're kind of fortunate enough to partner with them. But it is we do wrestle with them. I'd be lying if I said we didn't. I want to plug the Creative Brief Archive that you started. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about what that is and how they can get involved?
Yes, it's an absolutely free resource that I started on my website, creativebriefworkshops.com. And I need to give a serious nod and thanks to Biba Madison in Germany, because she started what she calls her creative brief bank. And I think she's got this set up on her Google Drive. And I have stolen many of the briefs that she's posted there, many of which I already had, but some of them I didn't. So I stole them from her and put them on my archive, but gave her full credit that this came from her bank. So the point is, there are almost endless sources online for all of us, creatives and non-creatives, to go to learn about the best TV spots and websites and design and typography and photography and everything else in the creative world, award-winning or otherwise. Where do you go to see examples of briefs? Well, except for Biba's bank and my relatively new creative brief archive, there is no place. So I've amassed, I think it's about 100 briefs on the Creative Brief Archive, divided by brand and by agency, if I know the agency. And they're also student briefs and professional briefs, and they go back many, many years, and some are more recent. And it's available for anybody. All you have to do is give me your name and an email address, and you're in. And you can read them, you can download them, you can comment on them. And for those of you who are shy about signing up for one more thing that requires your email, I promise you I'm not going to assault your inbox with a daily email. If I get it out once a month, I'm doing well. So this is a place for people to go, students as well as veterans, to see. And the other thing is, I have decided not to play referee. Every kind of brief is on this archive, because we can learn from brilliant briefs as well as not so brilliant briefs. We can learn what not to do as well as what we want to try to copy. So I've got a whole range of briefs on this, and it's growing. I'm trying to get more briefs. They're hard to get because, as you and I both know, Giles, they're proprietary documents. They reveal to the world how the agency thinks. So I get it. You know, when I reached out to my people in the ad world, you know, including you, you know, and they find out what I'm going to do with it, they said, no, just, you know, ghost him, crickets. And I understand it's a delicate and difficult situation, but you know, you can go back into your archives, your own archives, and pull out a brief that you did 8 years ago, and maybe you no longer have the client. It doesn't matter how old the brief is. I think my favorite brief, the one I love teaching over and over again, is 20 years old, but it's brilliant. And I finally met the author, and she was a guest on our podcast, and she gave us the backstory of how she wrote it. So, you know, I don't care how old the brief is. You know, when an art student studies art, they don't study the artist who did something last week. They study the artists who were doing great work 500 years ago, right? You learn from masters, and sometimes they're old.
Perfect. Yeah, I've made the point myself numerous times, more so about studying just old advertising in general. There's gold that so many nowadays or people entering the industry just aren't familiar with, and they'd be so much better off for it. So of course the same applies for the creative brief itself. So no, it's a wonderful thing, and I urge everyone to check it out and support if they can. Have you spotted any commonalities over the things that you've enjoyed? Has anything surprised you over things you've enjoyed reading in the briefs? Something that stood out that you weren't expecting to enjoy?
That's a great question. I think a brief that I found, and I didn't find the entire brief, I only found an excerpt from the brief, was written in, I believe, 1984 by what I'm guessing is a strategist, but it could have been an account person at Leo Burnett in Chicago, for a product that I think all of us have used, and it might be called something else in the UK, but here in the States it's called NyQuil. It's a nighttime cold medicine. It produced a campaign that has been running since 1984. So I found this excerpt and I read it over and over, and I love reading it during the training. I love including it in the workbook that I create, because when you think about a typical brief describing who our customer is, what do you typically see? What do you visualize? I see bullet points. A really bad brief will have bullet points: household income, demographics, you know, women age 18 to 54, Have you ever met a woman aged 18 to 54? I have no idea what they look like.
It's only more specific, right?
Yeah. I mean, Howard Gossage was famous for having said, I don't know how to write an ad for everybody, but I can write an ad for somebody. There's a lesson. So the typical description of a customer on a creative brief is a series of bullet points that add up to nothing. But here on this NyQuil brief, the first two words for the NyQuil brief were cold sufferers. That's who the target audience is. And then the brief writer went on to describe not who it is, but what happens when you get a cold. And it is laugh out loud funny. And it is a perfect example of creative writing, and you know it's not first draft. And the other thing is, it's not just a paragraph. It's three paragraphs. Three paragraphs of what happens to a human being when we get a cold. Because, you know, you think about it, who doesn't get a cold? We all do. So the brief writer said, I don't need to describe the demographics, even the psychographics. Just describe what happens. And this, to me, is a classic example of what Henry Gomez has told me many, many times. He says, when I write a target description for my briefs, I try to create a word picture such that it becomes a costume that the creatives can slip on and see the world through the eyes of that customer. Wow. If you can't do that, you think bullet points are going to accomplish that? No. No. Just write a paragraph. Be descriptive. As F. Scott Fitzgerald said, character is action. So describe what is happening when you get a cold. It's brilliant. And I think it opens lots and lots of eyes when I show that description in a workshop. And I say, well, can you write like that? And you get this deer in the headlights look in a lot of people. And I say, just nod your head and say yes, because you can, especially if you have a writing buddy who will help you.
Yeah, I love it. I'm going to go to listener questions, Howard, because there's one question in particular that kind of nods to this perfectly. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. We've had a few in. I'm going to start with Richard, who says, is there such a thing as the perfect brief template? If so, where can I get it?
I don't really care about templates. And I hear this all the time. I heard this from agencies say, there's something wrong with our template. We need to fix our template. I say, there's nothing wrong with your template. You just are writing bad answers to the questions. Fix your answers. Go fix the template.
Brilliant response. I mean, I was thinking exactly that with your describing what happens when you get a cold. That's not going to fit in every brief template.
Yeah,
so there's
Crispin Porter Bogusky had a format that I don't think any other agency could replicate. Unless you were inculcated in their philosophy of brief writing, if you look at their briefs and they're on the Creative Brief Archive, you're going to scratch your head and say, okay, how would I go about answering these briefs? And then there's the famous get to, how, by. That's a very sophisticated kind of format. And only the most astute and experienced brief writers can do it well, which is why I don't teach it. I'm not teaching marketers how to use that format because it'll just baffle them. Right? So don't worry about the template. Every template asks the same basic 4, 5, 8 questions. Focus on practicing writing better answers. That's what the creators want.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I love that focus on answers. I think you put a similar question to me when I had the pleasure of talking to you and Henry on the Brief Bros, and it was more of a case of just not thinking I could write a better brief template than already existed. We had, funny enough, it was another Richard, we had Rich Huntington of Saatchi & Saatchi on a few years ago now. And I remember we spoke about brief templates, and I remember he made the point that he used to believe in just having what he called a naked brief. So there was no pre kind of set headers or something. But he said that actually became more of a problem than not. But I think it kind of echoes your point about just making sure the answers are good enough.
Although I would say if I had to pick one template, I love the template that the Richards Group, now called TRG in Dallas, used. I don't know if they use it anymore. But their brief template, I think, is very simple, very straightforward, and it works. Plus, it has a built-in header. And I'm going to have to go from memory here, but the header has a subhead that says, most people don't like ads, most people won't read ads, most people don't believe ads. What will make this one different?
Yeah, love it.
So that's like a throwing the gauntlet down to the brief writer. It's a little intimidating, but I like it.
Yeah. It gives you a big shake before you start writing.
Exactly.
Love it. I'm unsure who to choose for the next question. I'm going to go with Sophie's. Sophie asks, having spent so many years as both a copywriter and then a creative director, do you find that one of those roles fundamentally changed how you approached the other?
I guess the biggest change that any good creative director, and I'm not going to claim that I was good, but I aspired to be good, the creative director has to let go of doing the creative work. And you have to nurture your direct reports and find out what each copywriter and art director or designer or other creative on your team does best and how they do it well and where they need support. And I knew that was what I was supposed to do. And my direct reports, if you found them, would probably give you varying answers as to my success in doing that. But I was at least aware that I needed to do that. And sometimes creatives are thrust into the leadership role and they have no training. They have no understanding of what it means to be a manager. It is an entirely different mindset. You have to feel comfortable. You have to solve a big problem if no one else can solve it. You have to be the go-to person to crack that egg if you have to. So you can't give it up completely. But you have to say, I'm going to trust you guys to do the work. And I will nudge and pull you back when you need to be pulled back and try to handle the human side of things. And, you know, we've talked about that a little bit on our podcast. There's more of that training available today, but there was none when I was, you know, a creative director.
Yeah, I feel very seen there in terms of a creative thrust into a leadership role. Very seen indeed. The final part of the interview then, Howard, is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests. Starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self, apart from don't try and chat to Gus?
I don't know if this directly relates to advertising, but I think as a writer, and I knew I was a writer as young as, you know, age 9, my advice to myself would be start writing in your journal sooner and commit to it daily. I've been a journal writer now for the last 10, 12 years, committed. I wish I had started and stuck with it sooner.
Wow. I know another journal writer, a good friend of mine, and I think he's only about 2 or 3 years in, and I know he'd echo that point. Can you unpack that just a tad more? Like, what, how much do you write, and what do you think you get out of it most?
Well, I start my day with it. You know, I get up and brush my teeth and feed the cat. And then I sit down. The first thing I do, I don't even look at my phone. That's not the first thing I look at. I open up my journal and I start writing. Now, it could be 2 sentences or it could be 3 pages. It just depends on what I'm talking about. And it has to do with, this is what I did yesterday, because it's the next morning and I'm talking about what happened the day before. Or I could be talking about what I plan to do that day. Some of it is very self-reflective and talking about the challenges that I'm facing with my current writing projects or the training I'm about to do. And some of it is about, you know, personal stuff. But it is a discipline that I found really sets the tone for my day, because I'm jotting down what's happened. And it has benefited me in many ways. You know, I published a memoir 1.5 years ago, and I've just discovered that whereas I fantasized about being a novelist when I was much younger, I realized that I'm much better at talking about a world that I know rather than creating a world from scratch. So memoir has become something that has really excited me. And there's nothing like flipping back in an old journal and discovering something you had forgotten. If you hadn't written it down, you would have forgotten this. We can't keep that much stuff in our brains. So when you discover something and you say, oh my goodness, I completely forgot that I was thinking this, or I felt this, or this happened, that becomes fodder for your next, you know, project. So that's, I think, one of the key benefits of journaling.
Nice. Do you feel like your brain has improved? I feel like I might need to explain that. One of the points that I recall coming up a few times on the podcast is how, you know, the link between writing and thinking, and how writing really helps your brain just kind of not just process information, but become better at exploring thoughts and ideas, whether that's for kind of self-help and therapy or just developing a creative idea. Is that something that you've observed?
I'll quote Flannery O'Connor to answer that question. And I'm going to paraphrase because I like my version of it better than hers. But she said, essentially, I write because I don't know what I think until I read what I've written.
Wow. That's beautiful. I've never heard that. Yeah. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what, you know, I have these thoughts in my head, or I have these feelings in my head, or I have something in my head that's bugging me. And I don't know exactly what it is until I get it down on paper. And then, as any writer will tell you, getting it down on paper is the easy part. The hard part is then, okay, now what do I do with it? How do I shape it? How do I cut it, cull it, revise it, improve it? The real work begins once you have something down on paper. You can't revise a blank page.
Yeah, love it. Number two, Howard, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
Purpose advertising.
Bingo.
It has absolutely nothing to do with why we're supposed to be in this industry. I often ask, you know, young people who come on the podcast who are either still in school developing their portfolios or are recently graduated and maybe have their first internship or their first job, I say, if you're not comfortable selling Pop-Tarts or Band-Aids or hygiene products, you need to find a different line of work, because that's what we do. We sell mundane stuff and we make it fun. So if all you care about is changing the world by focusing on social justice, bless your heart, we have lots of nonprofits that can help you do that. But the advertising business, while that does happen, it's rare. So get good at selling widgets, because that's what we do. So purpose advertising has been this total distraction. And I think it reveals how many people in our industry are kind of, well, they don't like being salespeople for widgets. They're kind of embarrassed. So they need to do something that fits their image of themselves. And I'm completely comfortable. Some of the earliest projects or clients that I worked on in the beginning of my career, I was selling stuff that I don't use this stuff, but I got to figure out a way to do it. And that requires, among other things, it requires empathy. Can you walk a mile in another person's shoes? You can't sell them something if you can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Well said. Number three, are there any books that you would recommend? We'll link to How to Write an Inspired Creative Brief and How to Write a Single-Minded Proposition, of course.
Thank you.
Are there any others you'd add to the mix?
My buddy Cameron Day has three books out. It's a series. It's called The Advertising Survival Guide, and there are three parts to it. The first one is, I'm going to grab it from my bookshelf. It's called Chew With Your Mind Open. And it's about the beginning of your career, how to manage the early parts of your advertising career. And Cameron Day, as you may know, is a creative director and creative leader and creative thought leader. The second one is called Spit and Chiclets, Managing the Messy Middle Years. And the third one is called Stones and Sticks, Stage 3, The Highest Altitudes of Your Career. He's been a guest on our podcast. He's an amazing gentleman. The books I highly recommend. Anyone who wants to get into this industry should read these books.
Brilliant. We've had Cameron on, actually, and I can't think of him without thinking of his beautiful, beautiful is probably the wrong word, his hilarious sushi story where he came close to bringing down a plane. But I'll leave that to people's imagination.
Yeah, I'll have to call him on that, because, you know, when I lived in Austin...
Oh, please do, Howard. It's one of the best anecdotes you'll ever hear.
When I lived in Austin, we used to have lunch once a month because we lived just down the road from each other. And, you know, and I'm getting ready to move back to Austin here pretty soon. So I'm looking forward to reconnecting with my old buddy Cam.
Oh, amazing. Well, we'll link to Cam's books too. So that's a brilliant recommendation. And then number four is, we always dedicate every episode to someone. And we ask our guests to give the reason why. So would you dedicate this episode?
I'm going to dedicate this show to Tom Jordan. He is the retired chief creative officer of Hoffman York and the first creative director who really challenged me and for whom I won some early awards in my advertising career, but mostly because of the couple pieces of advice that he gave me that I have never forgotten. And he is probably not the originator of this advice, but the way he said it, I always give him credit for. The first one is kind of obvious. We all know this in the advertising world. You know a good idea because it must first be invasive before it can be persuasive. In other words, you have to get their attention before you can sell them anything. But the way he phrased it, it's like, yeah, I'm not going to forget that. Invasive first, persuasive second. But the one that I really think about, and Henry and I have talked about this one on our podcast, was Tom used to say to us, and we'd sit down and there would be idle times at the agency back in Milwaukee when I was first starting out, and he would give us assignments to work on ideas for ads that hadn't been done before. And so he would say to us, remember, draw the circle, but don't complete it. Trust the audience to figure things out. And you, if you do that, they will respect you. They'll respond to that kind of an approach. And I've never forgotten that. Too many times we see ads out there that hit you over the head with lack of subtlety because they're afraid that you won't get it. And
yeah,
and that's not how good advertising works. So I'm dedicating this to Tom. He's retired. I've tried to reach out to him, but I think he's just happy doing his own thing these days. Still living in Wisconsin, but I've never forgotten him. He's one of those creative directors who was a good teacher, whether he knew it or not. And that's who I'm dedicating the show to.
Amazing. What a great recommendation. This episode is very, very proudly dedicated to Tom Jordan. That's amazing. As a final call to action, if you're listening to this, you'll find links to all of the books discussed, to Howard's books, to The Brief Bros, which he heads up with Henry. Please do check those out, and the Creative Brief Archive, which I am adamant that I will contribute to as soon as I am able. How else can our listeners get more Howard?
Well, I am on LinkedIn, so you can find me there, and I post pretty regularly. Obviously, every week we add a link to our podcast. And on YouTube, I'm at Howard Ibach. You can find our podcast page, and I'm actually started to contribute more of these YouTube shorts. So it's a little series I called Brief Bites, a 1 or 2 minute video where I just offer a piece of advice on how to write a brief or how to look at a brief. And then I have a literary side to me. The memoir is one that I've published. I also have a mini bio that I've published on an old friend who's passed away a number of years ago. And that website is howardfrederickibach.com. So it's just a slightly different URL. But there you'll find references to my literary side.
Awesome. Fantastic. We'll link to that too. So listen, Howard, I knew I'd enjoy this and I have. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. This has been a lot of fun. Good talking to you again, Giles.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try. I can't get no call to action. Oh, I can't get no call to action. Yeah, hey, hey.